And then there's the highest level of awareness. There's human beings. Animals? Yes. Same physical properties as a stone. And then there's the highest level of awareness. There's human beings. Animals? Yes. Same physical properties as a stone. And yet, within us, as all ages of man have said, is this organizing intelligence that allows us to go beyond our physicalness, our animalness, if you will. But we are led to believe a lie. And the lie that we're led to believe is that there are limits. You had them foisted upon you from the time you were very little. And it is only in recent years, with the understandings of quantum physics and quantum healing, that there are no limits. And the evidence for it is what's going on in the world today. The fall of dictatorships, the presence of a man who was imprisoned for his views just a few years ago, now being the president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel. Lech Wałęsa being the president elected of Poland when a few years ago he was incarcerated for his beliefs. The fall of the Berlin Wall. A woman in Nicaragua deciding to run against a dictator who had been there for 9 years and winning that election, Violeta Chamorro, disposing of a Daniel Ortega. The freeing of a Nelson Mandela all at once. All at once. All in the one song. All of these things happening as we almost become blasé about these events. And then last week in the elections in South Africa, when they were predicting horrible results, when the people were going to vote to continue apartheid, 77% of the people, when they got behind that voting booth curtain in their own conscience, as the president, de Klerk, said, and he will become the Abraham Lincoln of South Africa. He said, the people of South Africa today transcended themselves and voted to end apartheid in South Africa. A step, a beginning step, but the consciousness, the knowing, that powerful, invisible intelligence that is in every one of us can move mountains, can make miracles happen, can get you to a point where you can go beyond all of the limits that you thought were your inheritance when you showed up in this world of form. All of the things that you were told as a young boy or a young girl, that what you can and can't accomplish, what can and can't be healed, what can and can't be accumulated, what we can and can't do, how far we can go, how high we can jump, how much we can make, what we can... All of these limitations we're beginning to discover at the quantum subatomic, subatomic level. There are no boundaries. And if there are no boundaries, then this physical world can become whatever we decide it's going to be, because that's what the physical world is. When you get to the highest level of awareness, and the question then becomes, how do I access this invisible organizing intelligence? How do I access it? How do I get a hold of it? This is how it works. For me, I know of no other way other than through meditation. Now, you can call it what you want. You can call it meditation, you can call it prayer, you can call it chanting, you can call it, again, it doesn't make any difference. You can call it soccer. It isn't what you call it. But, as Blaise Pascal, the French scientist, said, all of man's troubles stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone. All you have to do is learn how to sit quietly in a room alone to access this highest level of pure awareness that is there. And when you access it, you begin to discover that you're not alone. Meditation, going within, leaving the chatter level of your mind and going deep within, what it does is it shatters the illusion of your separateness. You begin to realize that you're connected. The connection is not physical. The connection is metaphysical. The connection is not in form. The connection is transform, beyond form. When you get that, and you go to this level, first when you start this, you discover how slimy your mind really is. And you find yourself thinking these endless thoughts and these endless thoughts and millions of them, and they go on and on and on, and you just sit there and you say, what is this? I'm not doing anything, and I'm thinking, and now I'm thinking about how stupid I am sitting here thinking, and nothing is happening, and you go through this doubt. You see, doubt is the way most of us have learned almost all the things that we learn. We don't learn from knowing. We don't learn from knowing, we learn from doubt. And so when you learn from doubt, at the quantum level, doubt affects what you are doubting. Doubt affects the observation of an object. The introduction of doubt in that observational process at the quantum level affects what you're observing. So if you can't get to knowing, like you know you can still skate, or you know you can swim, or you know you can ride a bicycle, if you can't get to that level in spiritual awareness or higher consciousness, or in manifesting abundance for yourself, or in creating fulfillment for yourself, or in healing yourself, if you can't get to the knowing level, then what you have, you're working on, is doubt. And if you maintain the doubt itself will interfere, because we're talking about now something that is not visible. It is invisible. It is beyond form. And doubt is right in there with it. So the doubt, the knowing, the surrendering, it's like when Deepak and I decided to do this together today. And whenever I come up on stage or when I write, I have this process that I go through I call surrendering. And you just get to a point where you know that you're not alone, that you have divine, invisible guidance available for you, and you go to this place, and you do all that you know how to do in the world of form, and then it's like this magical, it's almost like you put all of the worries and the doubts and the fears and the anxiety and the stress and the wondering, all of that stuff, you just put it in a balloon, and you just blow it up and you tie it, and then you let it go. And you watch all of that stuff go away, and you say, I will allow the God within me, the invisible organizing intelligence that has organized me with a brain that is capable of remembering things that happened to me 20 years ago, even though I had a different brain then. I will allow that magnificent organizing intelligence that is somehow outside of my physicalness and inside it at the same time to take over. And whatever then comes my way, in the way of difficulties, in the way of problems, in the way of struggles, I will view, instead of as they shouldn't be happening, I will view as lessons, as opportunities, as something for me to learn, as reminders of the spiritual being that I can become. I will not treat it as, why is this happening to me? Because I know now that my life is nothing more than a parenthesis in eternity. It started in a moment, it was born in a night, to perish in a night. when the soul slept in beams of light endlessly. And I trust that intelligence. I wonder how many of you know that in the world of highest awareness, nothing is impossible. In a tennis match that I was in not too long ago, on match point, a fella on the other side hit a ball, it was in a doubles match, and he hit it to the corner, and I had decided to meditate my way through this match because we were having a tough time with this team. And we got behind, and all of a sudden I went to this place where I got myself very centered and very focused and put my body in what they call an alpha state, and I began to just, with my breathing, and I just eliminated all distractions, all external things at all, and I tried to just become the tennis ball. Not to hit it, but to be it. And I began to see the ball like those balloons I described. I mean, I just couldn't miss anything. I was like in this magical zone, and I stayed there for the longest time, maybe 35, 40 minutes, which is just an eternity to stay at this level in a competitive thing. And I had no connection to anything. I didn't know about the wind. I didn't know about the people who'd gather around watching the match. And he hit this ball, and it was match point for us, and he hit it, and it was a winner, for sure. I mean, he hit it over to the corner so hard, and I was here, and I took off. And I ran as fast as I could run, and the ball had hit here and was bouncing over that way, and I got to the ball, and I hit it back, and I got the ball back. Now, the other two opponents weren't watching. They figured it was an outright winner, and they were turning around then to continue the game. My partner and I started to walk off the court, and they said, wait a minute, he didn't get to that ball. That bounced twice. And everybody around said, no, he got to it. And they said to me, how did you do that? How could you possibly have gotten to that ball? You could never have gotten to that ball, not from where you were. And I said to them, I know you're going to find this hard to believe. As I know you are. But the ball hit the ground, bounced up, and waited for me to get there. Now, it has never happened to me before. It's happened twice since. But it had never happened to me, and I play tennis almost every day. It had never happened to me, and I was as flabbergasted as they were. First of all, that I even took off for it, because it was in Hawaii and it was very hot, and I was like, what am I doing this for? As I was going for that ball, I saw it sitting there. And I was the ball. I was so intent on that somehow my experience of that moment was that it waited. Now, for those of you who go, has he flipped out, or what has happened, or whatever, I want you to know that doubt will keep you from ever experiencing such a thing in your life. Just the doubt. When you develop the knowing that, as Maharishi says, all things are possible at the unified field. All things excludes nothing. When you trust in yourself, you trust in the wisdom that created you. God bless you and thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, one of my best friends in the world, a man I love dearly, Deepak Chopra.
Really difficult to follow Wayne after that. So I'd like to, in the little while we have, just say the same things that Wayne has said, because there's nothing original for me to say, really. In fact, not only is there nothing for me to say that's original, or for Wayne, there is nothing original to say, because you know it all, as Wayne was implying, that that inner knowing that you have, you already know it. We are just illusions that you have manifested through your own desire instantly to remind yourself of something that you already know. We are perceptual artifacts. What really happens is that we get bogged down in that experience or the interpretation of the perceptual artifact. And in the last 200 years, even though Newton was a great scientist, his influence and that of Descartes, the French philosopher, has been so dominant in our culture that our whole culture and even our science has become bogged down in the superstition of materialism. That superstition of materialism says that sensory experience is the only crucial test of reality. What I can experience with my senses, what I can touch, taste, smell, see, hear, exists. That not only do my senses give me an idea of what's there, but they're extremely reliable. And we know even from common sense that that's not true. After all, sensory experience tells me that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. Sensory experience tells me that the ground I'm standing on is stationary and I know it's spinning at dizzying speeds and hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour. Sensory experience tells me that this has a certain shape, size, texture, look to it, a color, perhaps a certain odor or fragrance to it. And that too is really a superstition. That's not the intrinsic nature of this reality. It's a response of the observer. It's a manifestation, as Wayne would say it. It's a manifestation that our collective minds have created. By itself, this is made out of the same stuff as you and I are made out of, or galaxies are made out of, or clusters of nebulas are made out of. This is a response of a certain observer with a certain set of perceptual apparatuses. The human eye, for example, can see only between 370 and 500 billionths of a meter. There's nothing sacred between 360 and 370, but for practical purposes, it doesn't exist for most of us. Take a walk with your dog and you'll see the dog hears sounds that you don't hear. Smells, fragrances, and odors that are totally beyond your perceptual experience. What we experience as material reality is just a lens of perception giving us a very distorted and small and fragmented view of something that's much vaster, huger, abstract, and ineffable. The material universe, despite its enormity, despite its hugeness, despite its solidity, despite its physicality, is nothing other than a stepchild of a much vaster, more abstract and ineffable reality. So the question is, what is the real nature of the world? What's it really like? Because what we are seeing and touching and hearing and tasting and smelling is a response of our perceptual apparatus. And the fault of the instrument should not really be a reflection on the user. The user is behind the instrument. And you'll find actually the user of the instrument is the same no matter what instrument is being used, whether it's the snail's nervous system or a human nervous system or anything else. The question is, what's the real nature of the world? Sir John Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine, once made the statement. He said, I want you to know that there are no colors in the real world, that there are no fragrances in the real world, there are no textures in the real world, there's no beauty in the real world, and there's no ugliness in the real world. Out there, beyond our perceptual apparatus, is a radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup. And in the act of perception, we take that quantum soup, which is a field of infinite possibilities, all coexisting in an eternal continuum of the present, and we freeze that into the objects of material perception that are fixed in space and time. And when Wayne and I talk later about how in various states of consciousness you can manifest anything you want, then we go into the exact mechanics of how that happens. But we're doing it all the time. We are like magicians. We are real magicians all the time. We're like King Midas, who could never know the true texture of a rose or the soft caress of a kiss, because everything he touched turned into gold. In the same way, in the very act of perception, we take this field of infinite possibilities, this huge, ineffable, abstract nothingness, and out of it, we create material reality. The tragedy, of course, is that we keep doing it along very strict limitations between the boundaries of our own preconceived notions of how things should be, as a result of our own indoctrination, which is a product of perhaps our culture or religion or dogma or ideology or belief. These are limitations. Belief is a limitation. It is belief and it is conceptualization, it is idea, it is dogma, it is ideology, it is thought that confines, that takes that eternal continuum and creates an idea out of it. And that idea is what manifests as a space-time event, which we called first the mind and then the body. But we are neither. We are neither the body nor the mind. That's why the Rishi says, when I really found out who I was, I realized that I was not in this world, the world was in me. I'm not in the body is in me. I'm not in the mind is in me. Body, mind, and world just happen to me because I find it interesting. But in my true state, I know that I curve back within myself and I keep creating within myself. I curve back within myself and I keep creating again and again and again. And the miracle is not this world of manifestation, although it is in a sense. The miracle is that the God in embryo that is performing these miracles is inside of us. That in fact we are already doing it. Which reminds me of another conversation that I once heard a long time ago between, again, a rishi and his disciple. And at one point the disciple turns to the rishi. He says, you know, you seem so enlightened, you must be able to perform miracles. And the rishi says, life is a miracle. Life is a miracle. I am beyond miracles. I'm completely normal. Life itself is a miracle. So the only problem with you is that you see the world in yourself and I see the whole world in myself. You see yourself in the world and I see the whole world in myself. It's a minor perceptual shift that you need to make between what is called object referral and self-referral. And we'll talk about that later, perhaps in detail. But our whole current mythology of what and who we are is based on the superstition of materialism, which says that I'm a physical machine that has learned how to think. And if I have thoughts and ideas and concepts and notions and ideology and dogma, if I fall in love or begin to dislike people, or I believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation or communism or feminism, any of this, it's all because of the dance of molecules. Thought is an epiphenomenon produced by physical matter. Consciousness is the epiphenomenon of matter. Molecules move around and the dance of molecules somehow produces this epiphenomenon that we experience as thought. And our whole way of looking at human beings in terms of health or disease, etc., is all based in this whole idea that if this is a material body, then we can heal it only through materialistic means. And today I'm not going to go into the whole notion of how magic bullets came about, how our whole system is thoroughly confused in that it mistakes the mechanisms of disease for origins of disease. And even though we can effectively interfere with mechanisms of disease, unless we realize what the origins of disease are, we will never be able to have the experience of health. Mechanisms of disease can be very effectively intervened and interfered with drugs and surgery and pharmaceuticals, but they're only a temporary measure, because mechanisms of disease are not the origins of disease or of health. Origins of disease and health have to do with understanding life itself, how life manifests through our physiology as process, not as molecules. The processes of eating, breathing, digesting, metabolizing, elimination, thought, sensory experience. We are the metabolic end products of our experiences. Because the body is nothing other than a printout of experience. And we, of course, think of experience as something external, something stimuli in the environment that impinge on our nervous system and somehow give us an experience, much like a tape recorder. You can press the button which says record, it'll record all the stimuli, and afterwards you can press the button which says play, and it'll play back the same stimuli. But if that were the case, then we would all be having the same experiences, given the same situation and same circumstance, same person or thing. We know even from common sense that's not so. Smell a fragrance and I can remember an old romance. Somebody else remembers, smells that same fragrance and gets nausea. Somebody else smells that same fragrance and breaks out into a rash. Go see a movie and you walk out after 2 seconds and your best friend goes and sees it 6 times. It's the best thing they ever saw. And that is because an experience has nothing whatsoever to do with any external event. Whenever you're reacting to anything, whether it's a traffic jam or a love note or criticism from your boss or a sip of coffee or the rainy weather, you are reacting to a signal generated within the self to itself. The whole mechanics of creation of the entire universe is nothing other than the self interacting with its own self and experiencing its own self, now as the observer, now as the process of observation, and now as the observed. In reality, the observer, the process of observation, and the observed are all self-interactions, experiencing themselves with different qualities of attention. The whole mechanics of creation is the self experiencing itself as different qualities of its own attention. And there's a very precise mechanics by which this happens. Very precise mechanics by which this happens. Once we understand that, then it becomes possible to realize that it is really possible to manifest anything in physical reality, and there are relative degrees of ease with which we can do it. The human body is not just a lump of inert matter with consciousness as an epiphenomenon. The human body is a river of intelligence, of information and energy that's constantly and ever in dynamic exchange with the rest of this huge reservoir of intelligence, energy and information. And this dynamic change is going on in every second of our existence. Our physical bodies, as Wayne was saying, he was skating with his 1991 model, even the memory wasn't in that model at all. Memory is primordial to its physical expression. Current science says that all of the information which we have, which structures our bodies, is contained in the DNA. But that's wrong. The DNA is not the source of information, it's the expression of information. The information itself is in a much more abstract field. Just like when you read a book, when you read Wayne's book, the real magic is not in the ink. The ink is not the source of the book. It may be the means of transmitting the information. The information is in his consciousness. And the consciousness is not in matter at all. It expresses itself as matter. It conceives, governs, constructs, and becomes matter, but in itself it's not matter at all. And the human body is a river of intelligence and information, constantly in exchange with this huge other reservoir of intelligence, energy, and information. And you are changing your bodies more easily, more effortlessly, more spontaneously than you can change your clothes. Even the physical bodies that you're using to sit on these chairs aren't the ones that you walked in with a little while ago. You can take a number of physiological processes, just the simple act of breathing. With each breath that you inhale, you breathe in 10 to the power of 22 atoms from the universe. It's an astronomical amount of raw material that comes into your body, becomes your heart cells and kidney cells and brain cells and DNA and bone cells. With each breath that you breathe out, you're breathing out 10 to the power of 22 atoms that are coming from every little bit of your body. You're literally breathing out bits and pieces of your heart and kidney and brain tissue. And technically speaking, we are intimately sharing our organs with each other all the time. Walt Whitman once said, every atom belonging to you as well belongs to me. And this is not a poetic metaphor, it's a fact of physiology. Because indeed, every atom belonging to you belongs to me. Here I go, staking my claim on things like pieces of property and mortgages and cars and bank accounts, when I can't even proclaim exclusivity over my physical body. In fact, based on radioactive isotope studies and mathematical computations, you can prove beyond a shadow of doubt that right this moment in your physical body, you have 1 million atoms that were once in the body of Christ, or Moses, or Buddha, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Michelangelo, or Mr. Saddam Hussein, or Adolf Hitler. Think of anyone that's ever existed on this planet and you have raw material this moment in your physical body that was once in that body. In just the last 3 weeks, a quadrillion atoms have gone through your physical body that have gone through the body of every other living species on this planet. And you can do radioactive isotope studies and show beyond a shadow of doubt that in less than 1 year, you replace 98% of all the atoms in your physical body. That you make a new liver every 6 weeks, a new stomach lining every 5 days, a new skin once a month, a new skeleton. It seems so hard and solid and permanent, but you replace your skeleton once every 3 months. Even the brain cells that you think with as carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, they didn't exist 1 year ago. And the DNA, which holds memories of millions of years of evolutionary time, the actual raw material comes and goes every 6 weeks, like migratory birds. And in less than 2 years, you replace your entire body. You want to be a stickler about this and account for the last atom in every little bit of collagen and cartilage. In less than 2 years, you replace your entire body down to the last atom. So if you think you are your physical body, then at least from a scientific perspective, it's a bit of a dilemma. Which one are you talking about? The 1992 model is not the same as the 1991 model. And here I am in Detroit with my 1992 model. And in fact, I did come here a couple of years ago. What's happened to that body that I brought with me 2 years ago? What has happened to that body? It's dead. It's gone. It's recycled earth, water, and air. And so I don't need any further proof of the fact that I'm constantly outliving the physical death of my molecules. The molecules are just the carriers of who I am. I'm not my physical body. Perhaps my body is just the place that my memories call home for the time being. My skin cells change once a month, but they don't forget the difference between hot and cold. My stomach cells change every 5 days. They don't forget how to make hydrochloric acid. My taste buds change every 6 weeks. They don't forget the sweet taste of strawberry ice cream. My memories are constantly reincarnating as my physical molecules. The shelf life of my molecules is short, but the shelf life of my emotions is longer. The shelf life of my psychological makeup is even longer, but there's a part of me that has no shelf life at all, because it's in the timeless, it's in the continuum of immortality. And today again, scientists are able to prove this. The scientist whom I only met 4 or 5 days ago, and she's dying to meet you, Wayne, a scientist by the name of Candice Pert, who was the head of molecular biology at the National Institutes of Health, several years ago proved beyond a shadow of doubt that every time you have a thought, it becomes a molecule. That in fact, thinking is practicing not only brain chemistry, but body chemistry. And these thoughts, which we are constantly having, which are self-interactions in our own consciousness, are translating into precise messenger molecules coming from inner space, from that void of pure potentiality. And you can think of these messenger molecules as having receptors to them, and the receptors have very precise, like little locks that fit into keys. There are receptors all over our body. That's how brain cells speak to each other. And there are receptors to these neuropeptides, not only in brain cells, but in all the cells of our body. So if you look at immune cells, for example, cells that protect you from infection and cancer and degenerative disorders, you'll find that immune cells have the same receptors. Your immune cells are constantly eavesdropping on your internal dialogue. Any thought you have, any feeling, any emotion, the immune cell is also experiencing that same feeling, thought, and emotion. Not only do immune cells have receptors to these neuropeptides, as they were initially called, neuro because they were found in the brain, and peptides because they are protein-like molecules, not only do immune cells have the receptors, but they can make the same peptides that the brain makes when it thinks, the same proteins. So that is a really startling finding, because it implies that immune cells are thinking cells. They may not be verbally as elite as the brain in that they don't speak in English, but if they use the same chemical codes that the brain makes when it thinks, then they're obviously thinking cells. They're conscious little beings. In fact, you ask a good neurobiologist the difference between the immune system and the nervous system, and they'll tell you there isn't any. The immune system is a circulating nervous system. It's a thinking system. So if you're depressed, your immune cells are depressed. If you're jittery, they're jittery. If you're happy, they're happy. If you're exhilarated, they're exhilarated. And scientists today can in fact pin down the exact molecular messenger codes that are produced by these immune cells. For example, if you're jittery, then the immune cells produce adrenaline. They're jittery immune cells. If you're feeling exhilarated, they produce interleukins and interferons, which are powerful anti-cancer drugs. Which if you had to go buy a full course of interleukin for the treatment of kidney cancer, for example, it could cost you $40,000. But conceivably, you could go on a joyride on Magic Mountain in Disney World, and you could make millions of dollars worth of interleukin-2. If that's your idea, this is fun. Only the idea. It's the idea that structures the molecule, and the idea is an interpretation of the self to itself. Because there is nothing other than the self. That's why, again, the Vedic Rishi says, I am that, you are that, all this is that, and that's all there is. When you get to that level, then you realize that, in fact, not only are you and I made of the same stuff, we are the same stuff. We are the same being interacting with its own self and experiencing itself through different qualities of its own attention to itself. That's all. And this body that we experience as a physical body is nothing other than a field of self-interactions generated in that field. It's nothing other than the field of self-interactions. This whole body is nothing other than a field of ideas. That's all it is. Therefore, the mind and the body are not two separate things. It's not that mind is here, and the body is here. The body-mind are one, inseparably one, in every aspect of our physiology, and in fact, in every aspect of our cosmos. And it is not that the mind is in the body, it's the other way around. The body is in the mind, and the mind is in something even much larger. We'll try and show that diagrammatically in a little while. Body is contained in the mind because the mind extends outside the body. So coming back to these messenger molecules that are not confined to the body, that extend outside the body, they're known as pheromones. And pheromones are communicator molecules like the neuropeptides. If you infect that plant out there with a virus, then it will give off hormones into the atmosphere that let all the other plants know that there's an infection going around. So that plant is a localized concentration of awareness in a larger field of awareness that shares its awareness with other localized concentrations of awareness of a similar kind. Ants do that, termites do that. You see, it's perfectly orchestrated social behavior in termites, ants, and insects. A queen bee regulates the whole behavior of her colony because she knows what hormones to secrete. And those hormones then influence the behavior, the whole social behavior in that colony. And animals do it. There have been experiments in California and the USA where some scientists took some mice and gave them electrical shocks. And after a while, they remove the mice from the room and bring other mice into the room. As soon as these other mice enter the room, they panic because they've inhaled the hormones of fear. So now when you say, I went into this room and I felt the atmosphere was really tense, that's not a metaphor, but a fact of physiology. You say, I went to this holy shrine, this church, and I felt peace, love, and compassion. Not a metaphor, but a fact of physiology. Or when Wayne said that he was experiencing Jack's presence in this room, that's not really a metaphor. If you can go beyond the mirage of Maya, you'll see that it's not a metaphor at all, but a fact of physiology. He said, I don't know what it is about this person, but he gives me the creeps. That's a fact of physiology. I say, Emerson once said, who you are shouts so loudly in my ears that I cannot hear what you're saying. A fact of physiology. So it is the senses through their own self-interaction that break the continuum of eternity, eternal time, eternal space into that space-time event. The space-time event is the thought, which then becomes the molecule. So you're used to the expression, everybody is familiar with the expression, first there was the word, and the word was made into flesh. Well, in modern terms, we can say first there was the quantum fluctuation, and it was made into the neuropeptide. That neuropeptide, that quantum fluctuation, is a space-time event in a field which is beyond space and time. Einstein's definition of a field, he said, instead of being an actual model for space-time events, a field is the continuum of probability distributions for possible measurements as functions of time. Now, I know it sounds complicated, but bear with me for a minute and it'll be very clear.
This is the end of tape 1. The program continues with Dr. Deepak Chopra on tape 2.